Hello and welcome to We Still Love It Tomorrow. I'm Dave.
And I'm Annie. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
So, I have no words.
And so it begins.
This month, Dave's choice was the 1992 Rutger Hauer action movie, Split Second.
Hooray!
Why? Dear God, why?
So, when I was at university, so we're talking the early 1990s.
You are so old.
I am so old. There were lots of terrible films which my friends and I used to enjoy watching after consuming possibly one or two light ales.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about things like Predator, other Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, this kind of stuff, other similar 80s and 90s sort of schlock sci-fi action films. And I thought it would be interesting to go back and see whether or not something like this held up.
I think I really wish I'd been drunk watching this.
I think that probably would have been considerably better.
Yeah.
The main thing that I want to say in this episode is that for some time, I have been looking for a film for us to talk about, which is so bad that it becomes amazingly good. And several
things. I succeeded
things.
With that with Hercules.
You did succeed with that with Hercules, but also, this was so good. Don't get me wrong, listeners, it was awful.
It was awful.
Terribly, terribly awful.
Yeah.
But it was so terribly awful, it came out the other side as a shining spectacle of amazingness.
I definitely wouldn't go that far. It had its moments.
What were your thoughts overall?
I can describe this film in four words.
Go for it.
All vibes, no logic.
Oh, yes.
And I have quite a lot to say about that, but we should probably get back to that because I have a lot and this is just the overall thoughts. But yes, it made absolutely no sense.
Oh,
and
yes.
Pretty much every choice that was made was to do with aesthetics,
mm-hmm,
and impact rather than anything to do with anything that made any kind of sense.
See, normally that would really, really wind me up.
Yeah.
But the vibes are so good that they either overpower the fact that the plot is non-existent or just terrible.
Yeah. I mean, I did write down, I'd written like two pages of notes, and then one of my notes says, 4 minutes in, I suddenly had an epiphany, why on earth am I trying to make this make sense?
Yeah.
And then I did enjoy it perhaps a little bit more. But anyway, I'm guessing it held up for you overall.
Oh,
because
God.
You seem to be burbling.
So I absolutely loved this when I came to a conclusion very early on that it was supposed to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And one of...
Was it, though?
Well, this is my issue, because one of the things that I was talking to a friend of ours about when discussing this film the other day was that this film has a lot of issues, and we'll go into a lot of issues.
Yeah.
But I honestly think that one of the big issues it had is that the people, the creative people behind the film, some of them thought it was supposed to be funny, and some of them didn't.
Yeah,
and those people didn't
tension.
Really communicate with each
yeah,
other.
I can see that.
And so it's very difficult to tell whether it's being done tongue-in-cheek or not.
Mm.
And so...
Yeah.
Would you like to attempt to give a plot synopsis?
Oh, it's super easy.
Okay.
Although I don't know whether I can do it with a straight face. Detectives Harley Stone and Dick Durkin hunt a monster through London in a future where the city is flooded due to global warming. And that's it.
Yeah.
But the fact that it was flooded due to global warming had no follow through and no impact whatsoever on anything to do with the story. And it was all, there was like the text that goes up, like at the start of Star Wars, of explaining the background to the film. And it was entirely, there's been this global warming thing and lots of rain and London is flooded. And A, London wasn't actually really flooded.
Mm-hmm.
And B, it had no impact on the entire film. Nobody mentioned it. There was nothing. And it didn't achieve anything at all. And I think was very confused.
It was a convenient excuse to have the characters run around in sets that were
like inch deep,
couple of inches deep in water, so that they could splash around in an impressively vibey way.
Yeah, vibes, true.
I mean, that was really fair. The only reason. And a couple of weird random shots of people on motorboats zipping down the Thames through the Thames barrier, which were absolutely unconnected to the rest of the film.
Yes, that was my point. It was largely unconnected. It made no sense because they were like underground spaces that weren't flooded.
Yes.
Nothing was flooded more than a couple of inches.
Mm-hmm.
I asked ChatGPT and 40 days of rain would not flood the city.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the roads were just fine.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. All vibes, no logic. Anyway,
100%, yes.
Do you have any facts?
I have quite a lot of facts. Do you want to go first before I do some and then you do some? What do you want to do?
I had a brilliant quote which said, from Wikipedia, the movie underperformed at the box office because it was released during the Los Angeles riots. I mean, really, was that the reason? Was that really the reason?
I mean...
Or was it just that it was shit?
I mean, you have to bear in mind that a lot of people were going to see a lot of films very similar to this at the time.
Yeah, but most of those were probably better.
I mean, I don't necessarily think so. However, it depends what type of film you are going for. There are a lot of what, at a certain point of time, would have been called straight-to-DVD films. Or, I guess, straight-to, you know, Hulu now, or whatever the lower-grade streaming services are. But a lot of those films in the late 80s, early 90s were still in the cinema. That said, this was up against an array of incredibly good films that year, because we had Unforgiven, we had A Few Good Men, we had Reservoir...
Oh, A Few Good Men.
We
epic.
Had Reservoir Dogs.
This was at the same time as Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Wow.
My Cousin Vinny.
Oh, excellent movie.
Aladdin.
The Disney one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And... Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the original.
The original film, which I've never seen.
Oh, interesting. So it's written by a guy called Gary Scott Thompson, who went on to write The Fast and the Furious, and Too Fast, Too Furious.
Okay.
So he went on to, if not better things, certainly dramatically more successful
yeah.
things. Yes. It was directed kind of, which we'll come back to in a minute, by a guy called Tony Malam, who's mostly known for doing documentaries, non-fiction, and a guy called Ian Sharp, who directed Who Dares Wins, which is an incredibly famous thriller about the SAS, which came out in 1982.
Okay.
It was filmed in only 8 weeks. Very quick for a film, but then again, there's not a lot to it.
There's really not a lot to it.
It stars Rutger Hauer, who's...
I was disappointed because I have a weird obsession with Rutger Hauer, and this was not his best moment.
Who is known for Blade Runner, Lady Hawk, The Hitcher, which I hate so much.
And the Guinness adverts.
And the Guinness adverts.
Where my obsession came from.
And also Blind Fury. Have you ever seen Blind Fury? That is a great film. And by a great film, I mean it's a very similar tone-ish to this. But it's, do you know what it's about?
I think so.
Super briefly, it's about a soldier who loses his sight and is then
yes.
found by a Japanese swordsman who teaches him to sword fight, even though he's blind. It is great.
Okay. Why do you hate The Hitcher?
Because something incredibly horrible happens to one of the characters right at the end.
Okay.
Which I won't describe. So yes, Rutger Hauer, Ursindil Duncan, who was Dick Durkin, who is mostly known for doing lots of voice work in extremely popular computer games, none of which I've played. Kim Cattrall. Doing...
And Pete Postlethwaite! I mean, what on earth?
We'll come to that in a second. But Kim Cattrall, 16 Years, Sex and the City. 5 Primetime Emmy Award nominations, 4 Golden Globe nominations,
she including has almost nothing to do in this.
Winning Best Supporting Actress, and she, for some reason, is in this.
Yeah.
But it's worth pointing out, before 16 years of Sex in the City and multiple high-level award nominations, she was in Porky's.
Yeah.
Police Academy.
Yeah.
And Big Trouble in Little China, which I think we did previously on the podcast.
We haven't, no. It's not eligible.
Why?
Because we've both seen it multiple times.
Oh, okay.
If we can find somebody who hasn't seen it, who's prepared to watch it, let's go for it.
And then, as you say, Pete Postlethwaite.
Pete Postlethwaite.
What is
Why?
He? What is he doing in this film? In this tiny
sadness.
Part? I mean, he must have already been like a major character actor by this time.
You would have thought.
I mean, he's, as you say, he's barely in it, so it's just a few quick bucks,
yeah.
But wow. So the script was originally written with an idea that they wanted their leading man to be
Harrison Ford. Yeah. Yeah, can't see it, but...
And now we get some quotes from Wikipedia, Veracity, who knows. During production, the script was changed several times, and there were many discussions about what the main villain character should look like, and whether it should be a person or a monster, which left the monster designer only 3 weeks to design the creature. So it feels like the film is being heavily rewritten while it's being shot.
Alien was before this, I assume.
I'm
the original
not
Alien was
sure.
Definitely 80s.
Again, I'm not sure.
Because I would say the monster in this was fairly heavily based.
So the rotation of things that we used to watch, I was talking about earlier, one of the things that's in that is Aliens, but the reason why I didn't mention Aliens in that list is because Aliens is really good.
Okay.
It's got genuinely good acting, good production values, really good music, really good cinematography.
Yeah.
Whereas,
do you want to guess when the original Alien film came out? I was right.
Go for it. 86?
79.
79?
Yep.
Wow. Okay. Whereas there's lots of other things we used to watch. Which,
Aliens was 86.
Yeah, which was similarly terrible to this, but Aliens, I maintain, is still a really well-made film now. Anyway,
okay.
So the film was being rewritten while it was being made, which must be really hard because obviously films are shot out of order. So
yes.
If you're rewriting it while it's being shot out of order,
yeah.
That must be incredibly difficult. And also it's all done in 8 weeks, so it's done incredibly quickly. Then I've got another quote from Wikipedia. Due to the high level of stress during production, I'm just trying to find his name, Tony Malam, who was supposed to be doing the directing, stepped back from finishing the film. So it's only 8 weeks long, but he didn't make it to the end.
Uh-huh.
So Ian Sharp and, quotes, and others joined in to finish the directing of the film.
Wow.
So it was just... From some way through, the person who's supposed to be directing it threw up his hands and went, I can't deal with the chaos that this is. I'm done. And other people just came in and kind of bodged it together at the end.
Yes. Well, the editing didn't help either because, I mean, poor old Durkin, there's a weird focus on the fact that he says that he gets laid every night and he keeps
yes.
going on and on about his
yes.
girlfriend. And I'm like,
mm-hmm.
I have a girlfriend. She lives in Vancouver.
So
apparently they did film a scene with her in it
yeah.
and then cut it out.
And then cut it
so
out.
So she does technically exist
mm-hmm.
in the film universe, but it just comes across as if he's just
yeah.
making it up.
It's true. So the film... something else that happened during production is they kept changing the name because they couldn't agree what to call
what
it.
What does it mean? What even is? I mean,
so,
I thought it was something to do with time travel, and no.
So it was called Black Tide originally.
Which
then,
makes a sort of certain amount of sense.
Then it was called Killer Instinct.
Meh.
At one point in time, it was just called Detective Stone.
Oh, wow.
And then now, as you say, it's called Split Second, which has
no
connection.
No relevance whatsoever.
So I honestly... didn't really know what it was about when I announced it at the end of the previous podcast because
you couldn't remember.
No, because there is another film which is probably in a similar vein to this but better, which came out around about the same time. So I won't stick it in the list for some time because it's probably too similar. Called Trancers, and Trancers is kind of a poor man's Time Cop.
Oh, Time Cop.
And do you want
that came out at a very pivotal moment in my adolescence.
who's the guy?
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Jean-Claude Van Damme. Oh, the splits.
Doing the splits up onto the kitchen cabinets lives in my head and ever will.
But in Trances, the guy who's the detective who's sent back from the future in order to catch the bad guy.
Oh, so it is something to do with time travel.
Yeah. Okay. Has, this is Trances, not this.
Yeah.
Has a watch, and when he pushes his watch button, it stops time for 6 seconds.
Oh.
So he's got 6 seconds to run around and do stuff before time starts again. And he uses that several times in the film to do stuff. And
that
I
sounds quite fun.
And I thought it was that.
Okay, so we watched the wrong movie.
We watched the wrong movie.
Wow. Okay.
It made $5.4 million in the box office on a budget of $7 million, so it lost money. It's got only 56% on Rotten Tomatoes, despite being described as having a significant cult following. People don't like it. And Metacritic gives it only 26%.
Wow. Well, fair. Because, let's... Okay, so the text at the start, as I said, makes no sense because it wouldn't happen, and it evidently didn't because most of the city isn't actually flooded and it doesn't really, you know, have any impact. Rutger Hauer as Detective Stone is wandering around in quite awesome boots and leather trousers, very, very bad in, you know, ankle deep water, and he has been diagnosed with some kind of PTSD anxiety because the monster killed his partner a couple of years ago. And during the course of him being suspended, he tracks the monster somewhere and then somebody gets killed while he is standing outside the bathroom in which this is happening. And he contaminates the crime scene.
Oh, yes.
By putting his coat over the dead body.
Yes.
He contaminates the second crime scene by shooting a rat with his giant pistol and exploding rat bits everywhere.
Such a giant gun.
And he'd been suspended, so he shouldn't be wandering around the city with a gun. And so, in response to this, the captain puts him back on duty.
Yeah.
Because that makes sense.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's one more day to save the city, Detective Stone, you know.
And the bit that made me laugh right at the start was when the first murder happens, and he's obviously very annoyed because he was right there, and he just kind of didn't spot what was happening. And he... No, it was actually before. He gets to the club and a Rottweiler jumps out from somewhere and starts barking at him.
Mm-hmm.
And he flips his badge open and he goes, "Police, dickhead!" And my thought process was, that's not a very nice thing to call a dog. Why would he think the dog would react to his badge? Oh, he must be talking to the guy who's got the dog on a leash.
No, he's not.
But no, he's not, because later... when the murder happens, he goes up to the dog and he kneels down next to the dog and says, "You saw him, didn't you, dickhead? What did you see?" And I'm like, is this a science fiction movie in which the dog is going to be able to talk to him? But no.
But no, because it's funny. It's funny.
Yes, but then he feeds the dog chocolate, so that dog is dead.
Well, it might be special future dog chocolate.
No.
Oh, your face. Oh, dear. So can I just...
the first 5 minutes.
Can I just read out the first, like, two things I wrote down?
Sure.
Funky boots, leather trousers, wearing shades at night, large cigar, huge gun. Man, those were the days. What happened to them? Closely followed by, oh my god, Rutger Hauer is so cool, I can't even stand it.
Okay.
Yeah! He's so awesome, because he's, you know... wears a leather jacket and has a huge gun, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, ordinarily, I'd be absolutely up for that, especially Rutger Hauer, but he didn't work for me in this. I was disappointed in him.
Oh, sadness.
Yeah, it was quite sad. Because I was quite excited when you said it was a Rutger Hauer movie, because I did have a weird Rutger Hauer obsession in the early 90s.
Well,
but I didn't see this because I was only 14.
Yeah. Incredibly cool. So he goes to this club and he seems to know where the killings are going to happen. And later on, his partner, who we'll talk about in a second, Dick Durkin,
yeah,
surmises that somehow he has some kind of psychic connection to the monster that lets him know what's going to happen.
Durkin, now, initially science boy, goes completely off the rails and puts together this nonsense theory of Satanism and
he's science boy, and then
the Chinese calendar and astrology.
Goes and gets all of these books and learns all about cults and about stuff, and then decides that it's all real.
Yeah.
But what was my point? My point was that, first of all, the psychic connection he has with the monster, never explored.
No, No, there was a whole explanation about that.
Was there?
Yeah, because says that the coroner guy says that the monster has all the DNA of all of his victims in it. Yeah, has some kind of connection and needs to kill them to complete its journey.
Okay.
Which is why when Kim Cattrall comes screaming up to him in the apartment building and goes, "Oh my God, it bit me!" And he goes, "Don't worry about it," and just walks off. I was like, shitbag. He also, in the club, a woman comes up to him, who is the first woman to speak in the entire film, and says, "I need to go to the loo. Will you watch the bathroom door for me?" Because it's a men's loo, and there doesn't seem to be a women's loo. And he says, sure, as an officer of the law. And then he just wanders off. And then she's brutally murdered by a monster.
Yes.
Shitbag.
Yes. I mean, that is a good phrase. He is absolutely that. Yes. But yes, he's followed or has anticipated the monster being at this club. So, segue just for a second. In The Matrix.
Okay.
Neo gets a message to follow the White Rabbit right at the start of the film and goes to a nightclub where he meets Trinity.
Yes.
And that location is absolutely unnecessary to the plot. But it has lots of people in fetish wear. It has people dressed up as Nazis burning books. It has people in cages, blah, 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 blah. And it's to give the film a certain vibe.
Yes.
A certain, you are cool because you wear skin tight leather and PVC.
Yeah.
Not because of, you know, the things that you do and you wear shades at night and all this type of stuff.
Well, I mean, so, if he wants to wear shades, he has to wear them at night in this film because it's never day.
That's a very good point. But
at no point is it daylight in this movie.
But what I'm saying is that both films are trying to achieve the same kind of coolness.
Yes, because that's the same club coolness that he goes to, essentially.
However, in The Matrix, you don't really think about it. Because it's just, this is the kind of thing that cool people do, that somehow, you know, societally we've got into our brains that...
Dress as Nazis and burn...
No. Go to nightclubs and wear, you know, PVC and shades and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in this film, it really doesn't work.
No.
Because he goes to this club and it's all kind of late 80s, kind of cyberpunk, kind of just... ordinary
a lot of bondage
punk.
Gear.
And there's a lot of random bondage gear in a very cheap... The whole film looks incredibly cheap.
Yes.
Environment. And there's a woman there in fetish gear waving her breasts around.
Yeah.
Quite a lot.
First woman we see.
For no real reason whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Yeah. I just yeah. There's just no point of this whatsoever.
No.
So as you say, someone is killed. I wrote down, I guess him futzing with the corpse isn't going to matter to the plot. Ooh, look at the size of that gun was the next thing that I wrote down. I'm obviously...
Yes. Well, they get bigger guns later on.
We will come to this.
Much, much bigger guns.
We will come to this later on.
And also, but even with his pistol with the giant barrel... He demonstrates in the shooting gallery underneath in the basement of the police station.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which serves no purpose whatsoever because he's not...
It does serve a purpose. Well, it's amazing.
It serves a vibes purpose again.
Yes,
but a practical purpose, no, because you don't need target practice with that gun because all of the targets explode.
Yes.
Which demonstrates that when he's holding the monster's heart in his hand at the end and shoots it with the giant pistol, he should really have shot his entire hand off at the same time. And it has been demonstrated the firepower of this weapon.
You're using your Earth logic. Stop it.
All vibes.
I have written in bold, the days of epic huge guns, whatever happened to them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this feels very 80s to me, so I think it's on the tail end of that kind of thing. Oh, it feels
very 80s. Very, very 92.
It surprised me it was that late.
So when he leaves the nightclub, there's a shot of driving through central London at night, which is exactly the same shot that we saw earlier in the film. And at this point in the film, we're only 15 or 20 minutes in, and they've already reused one of their shots.
Okay.
So it's like, okay. He randomly shoots a rat, which explodes, and I've just got written, ha ha ha, random rat shooting, really funny.
What?
I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Okay.
Shortly afterwards, he meets up with his dead partner's romantic partner, who yes. we've heard he was having an affair with.
When the partner died.
When the partner died. He turns up, I don't know how long it's been since he's seen her, but he calls her pretty, and then she almost immediately seems to proposition him, and then he completely ignores it.
But then when she wakes up in the morning in his really incredibly disgustingly scummy flat.
Yes.
he has kind of melted chocolates onto the fridge door in the shape of a heart. And
yes.
despite the fact that his flat is incredibly scummy.
Yes.
She shloops one of them off the fridge and eats it. And it was so grim. Almost as grim as him digging a half full cup of coffee out of the sink
and then drinking it the next morning. I've got a line grim. Written down here that I do not know what it's in relation to, but it just says comedy pigeons.
Oh, when he wakes up, he's got a pigeon on his head.
They had to hire a pigeon wrangler to bring a bird in for a day so he could wake up with a pigeon on his head. That's yes. just amazing.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, I love that so much. Okay, before I talk about the next thing, do you want to talk about Dick Durkin?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I've got an awful lot else to say.
So he's the comedy pairing. He wears a tweed suit.
He does Tai Chi.
He does Tai
Chi. In his tweed suit and tie on the bonnet of his Jeep.
Yes, it's true. He's very, you know, proper. He's highly academic. He's been paired with Rutger Hauer's Do Whatever It Takes. Like,
keep him under control, and it goes very far the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And by the end, Dick Durkin is running around with the biggest gun in the world.
So.
And exploding rats.
The important thing to note about, well, one of the many things to note about Dick Durkin is about 75% of the way through, he gains a leather jacket.
Does he?
Yeah.
I missed that.
He gains a leather jacket, at which point he becomes cool.
Aha. Uh-huh.
He stops being uptight, you know, trying to rein Rutger Hauer in.
He turns.
And he wears a leather jacket and becomes
and runs Rutger around Hauer's with a giant gun. But yes. Do you know what actually cements him as an 80s action hero?
No.
The monster carves an incredibly complicated sigil that runs all across his entire torso. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And he's fine.
He's fine. Yes, he basically ignores it.
Yeah. He doesn't even actually realise it's there.
Yeah.
Yes, I had written down, and I realise that there's an added bit to this because Stone does strip Durkin when he finds the, but he is like finding the sigil. Mm-hmm. But there's also hair stroking and face cupping.
Is there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I missed that. But then completely.
There's also hair stroking and face cupping on the part of the monster.
Really?
Hair stroking and face cupping of Stone by the monster. There's hair stroking and face cupping of Durkin by Stone.
Wow.
And also hair stroking and face cupping of Stone by the monster.
Okay, I missed all of this completely. Amazing. Yeah. What was
But that's definitely the chemistry between Stone and Durkin is streets ahead of Stone and Michelle?
Yeah, whatever her name was. Yeah. So Durkin goes off and decides to do all this research into the supernatural. Mm-hmm. Then comes back and explains that he thinks that Stone has psychic powers because he's read it in a comic book.
Yes.
And that's how he's learned how these things work.
Yes.
So...
I was a little bit disappointed in him.
He runs 5 miles every morning, is it?
Yep.
Gets laid every night.
Gets laid every night and then gets up and runs 5 miles every morning.
Yep.
And the girlfriend is definitely not imaginary.
Apparently. I've written down at one point, seems extremely excited by the prospect of a cooked breakfast.
Yes. Well, oh, I mean, why wouldn't you be?
Just, sorry, briefly, slightly out of sync, having the sigil carved in his chest, we do not know why the monster leaves some people alive, because the monster also goes to the apartment where
Michelle is. Shower.
Yes.
And lurks around outside the shower and then goes and kills somebody in a different flat.
Yes.
For, you know, because vibes. It makes sense.
Yes. But also, listeners, if you can help me in some way, there is another film, the internet has failed me here, in which one of the characters reveals that they had been like an undercover cop or something who'd been in a cult and had a symbol carved in their chest as part of some ritual. And they take their shirt off and go, look at how committed I've been to doing this sort of thing in the past, and points to this thing carved in their chest. And I have a very strong memory of seeing that, and I cannot find the film.
Familiar.
Can't work out what film that is at all. So if anybody knows, please drop us an email or contact us on social media, because I can't find it. Dick Durkin, also excellent comedy value, when they're creeping up on the monster at the end, and it's...
he just falls in a hole.
In a flooded passage, and he just disappears into a hole in the ground. So, yeah. So, what else have we... we got another random comment I've got in the middle of this, which is just, I haven't laughed so much in ages. This is really great. One last quick thing for Dick Durkin. He gets shot in the chest.
He does, and blasted backwards out of a second story window.
Out of a second story window.
And he's fine.
And we think, oh, well, that's like the end of him. Or possibly, maybe he's got a bulletproof vest. And then he turns up and he says, and I quote, oh my God, what a rush. Other than that, is absolutely...
No, he does say he had a bulletproof vest.
Yeah, yeah, but it's just like, oh my God, what a rush. He's
Yeah,
you know,
but he's fine, yes.
He's enjoyed the being shot out of the window. So
blasted through a window, yes.
Yes, and then later on they go to a morgue.
The police morgue has a whole load of corpses on platforms that are hanging from the ceiling.
Oh, yes.
Surrounded by plastic sheeting.
On
with
drips.
IV bags and blood bags, like they're getting transfusions.
Yes, it makes no sense.
What's the actual fuck, Gregory?
It makes no sense at all. And sitting there is Jason Watkins, who
looks very much like Simon Pegg.
Who's an actor that I mostly know from a TV show called Being Human, but also lots of other places. When he looks like, I don't know, 18 in this, and he gets like 20 seconds worth of screen time. But the only reason why I bring it up is because he turned up on screen and I immediately recognised him. And then I went, I know him, he's from Being Human, and looked him up and I was like, yes!
So okay.
All I'm saying is my memory's not always absolutely terrible.
Fair.
It's very random.
Yes, that was where I'd actually first wrote down all... No, it's not. All Vibes, No Logic is after they were in the morgue.
Hmm. So, yes, that was...
Because nothing about that makes any sense.
Absolutely nothing about that makes any sense at all. So, what else have we got? We get to fight the monster at the end. I wrote down it feels a bit more like Nightmare on Elm Street now. There's a bit...
Yeah, it definitely shifts.
There's a bit where at some point...
there's a monster.
They're standing near, I don't know, a hole in a wall or something, and rats... leap out of them in inverted commas, and it's just they've got someone standing off camera basically
throwing rats
at them.
Yeah.
It's just, what was your job today? I threw rats at Rutger Hauer's face. It's just amazing. What else have we got on here? So they decide they need, and I'm using the best air quotes of all time here, we need bigger guns, bigger fucking guns.
Yes.
And I bring this up because my old university friend, Mike, who is 99.9% never going to listen to this, would say that roughly every, I don't know, 3 or 4 days for at least a couple of years. It was like his absolute favourite thing to say at random intervals. He would just go, we need bigger guns, bigger fucking guns. He just said it all of the time.
Yeah.
So that was highly amusing. Just before they go and fight the monster, Dick Durkin says, if I was a religious man, I wouldn't say that this thing thinks it's Satan. I'd say, it is Satan.
And then someone says, Satan is in deep shit.
Oh, I missed that.
That's the quote I wrote down. Because they've got the bigger fucking guns.
So they've got basically Gatling shotguns.
Yes.
Which is the silliest thing I think I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But the monster is still proving to be unkillable when they go to like the deserted tube station, like, I don't know, the end of Vendetta or, you know, a lot of other things. And Mokuhara eventually kills it by doing the same thing to it that it did to all its victims, which punches it in the chest and rips its heart out. And I was watching this at, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something, and I was laughing so loud at this point that I thought I was going to wake you up because it was just so awesome.
But then there's bubbles in the water that suggest that it's not dead.
Yes.
Classic ending.
I've written down mid-explosion snogging.
Oh, yes. They electrocute it and blow up the train car that it's in somehow, and they're kind of like blasted out of the way, and then Stone and Michelle just have a quick snog for reasons.
Yes. So I've got some other tiny bits to throw in quickly.
Go on.
So you mentioned Rook Howard's awful flat.
Yes.
So one of the things that happens is they open the fridge at some point, and in the fridge, his fridge is full of Alpha Max pills because he's an Alpha Max man.
What?
I don't know. It just sounds like the kind of thing that his character would do.
Okay.
It's just very weird. He subsists entirely on
coffee and chocolate.
Coffee and chocolate. Caffeine, coffee, blah. Chocolate, caffeine, chocolate, caffeine, chocolate, caffeine.
Yes.
As I think is said at some point in time in the movie, because that was also a quote that got used by my friends a lot at university. I'd forgotten how much this got quoted by people at the time.
Uh-huh. Well, I can understand why that... And he gives it a special place in your heart.
And he persuades Dick Durkin that he should go on the all-caffeine chocolate diet partway through the film. Oh, and cigars, of course, very, very important. Have you ever seen Sledgehammer?
Yes.
So, for listeners who haven't, do you want to describe it?
No.
So, Sledgehammer was a comedy TV series... detective series about a detective called Sledgehammer, who had two...
Very flat hair.
Very blonde, very flat hair, and had two, I think, like, pearl-handled, I think possibly gold-coloured pistols that he had a very unhealthy relationship with, that, you know, were under his pillow at night and various things. And it was a straight-up comedy of... Sledgehammer mostly kicking down doors and shooting people, and it was very silly and very funny. And it occurred to me partway through that Rutger Hauer was just playing Sledgehammer, and it was just very, very ridiculous.
Yeah.
So the head chief of police says right at the start of the film that after Rutger Hauer had been put on suspension when his partner was killed. So they say he went and worked in every hellhole in the world and he's been fired from every single one of them. And then somebody else says, yes, but he's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
Have you got anything else?
It had weird swing music over the credits at the end.
Oh.
Just out of nowhere, suddenly we're having 40s swing music. It was so weird. I, in my enthusiasm of writing down quotes and all of the bits that I thought were really funny, forgot to write down any diversity data. So
okay. So, as we have already said, the first woman that you see is a bondage stripper in a chainmail bikini and a gimp mask who flashes her tits at everybody. The first woman who speaks has one line and is then brutally murdered by the monster in the bathroom. The second woman who speaks is at least a policewoman, and she says to Stone, "It's good to have you back," and then gives him the most lecherous look I have ever seen anybody give anybody in anything. And then there's Kim Cattrall, and I mean, I don't really know. She does do okay because she doesn't really have an awful lot to do, but she is an active participant in the climax because they find her strung up in the sewers, and she has to swing back and forth to actually get to a point where Durkin can grab her so that they can release her. And then she takes one of the massive guns.
Yeah, but before that, when she's swinging around, she does one of the most athletic things I've ever seen, where she lands on top of the tube train.
And then falls backwards. It's then, like, nobody's back should bend that like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm surprised she didn't get horribly injured. But then there's a bit where they need to get to the fuse box, and it's behind a metal grill, and Durkin goes, "Oh, we need a screwdriver," and she just shoves him out of the way and then bashes it with the giant gun,
yeah.
and it falls out. So she is, you know, more active in the climax than I expected, but up until that point, not really much to her.
She does get a big fucking gun, though.
Yes, she does want to get one of the big fucking guns, it's true. And she does use it, and I was quite impressed. In terms of other diversity, the bullpen at the police station initially appears to be 100% male and 100% white, but there is one Asian female extra later on and one black male extra later on, and that's it,
okay.
as far as I spotted.
Mm-hmm.
And no, all of the speaking parts are white.
Mm-hmm. But there's only, what, like 8 speaking parts in the whole thing, and only really Stone, Durkin and Michelle get more than 10 words in the film. Really,
but it is still
very,
almost 100% white.
Oh yeah.
Event, like entire cast.
Mm-hmm.
So not great.
There is a little bit on mental health because,
but not really.
Well, only that it's mentioned that Stone's got PTSD, and every so often he has like a panic attack, and then people go to help him, and then he normally points a gun at them,
yeah.
and they try to do that.
It's not a great representation.
It's not,
as it goes.
Not at all good representation, but it's still. I just still find it amusing. You know, you shouldn't, but still. Anything else?
I don't think so.
Okay. So, that about wraps it up for this month's discussion. Time for the ratings. As people know, we use a 5-star scale with half stars allowed. Dare I even ask?
I'm going to go 2.
Okay.
That's all I have to say. How about you?
Well,
go on.
So I came in really planning to just give it a 5.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we've talked about how it's, you know, actually terrible.
You
can
give it a 5 if you want.
I think I'm going to still give it a 5.
Excellent. Okay, good. Cool. I mean, I know you still loved it. It does goes without saying, based on...
Okay. Right. Yes. What are you going to...
I am going to pick something which is exactly the same, but completely different.
Same, same, but different.
Where's that from?
YouTube.
Okay. And I'm going to pick Red Dragon.
I don't think you can.
Why?
Because I've seen it.
Oh.
It's really good.
It is really good. Oh, I'm sad now.
We could just wind that back and I could pretend I've not seen it.
No, it's fine. Well, I did have a book. How do you feel about doing a book?
Maybe. Sure.
Okay. So, because I am right in thinking that you haven't actually read the Shadowrun books.
No.
Okay, great. Because I borrowed one from Juliet Simon.
Okay.
So we're gonna read one of the Shadowrun books.
Awesome. Cool, I look forward to it.
Which was inspired by Akira.
Oh, okay. So I played a lot of the Cyberpunk role-playing game, but I never played the Shadowrun role-playing game.
Okay.
And they're similar, but also same, same, but different.
Okay.
So, cool. Right.
So that's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell us about a time you shared some media that you love, and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.
You can buy our merch at bit.ly/loveittomorrowpodcast with dashes where the spaces should be.
You can follow us on Blue Sky at still-love-it.bsky.social.
And please join us next month to find out what Dave thinks of whichever Shadowrun book I've got.
Excellent. And whether or not Annie still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.